few more people should sit here. Doesn't look nice. Yeah, right here. These three chairs. Mira, Sandy, Ross. Yes. And here comes our Sai Baba. Yeah. Sandy's afraid of you. Yeah. Jas, Mira needs company. You know, I'm going to tell you a story which suddenly I remembered this afternoon. That will put bhakti in proper context. I promised last time, and which is again, my God, quite a long time ago, because all this flu and things, almost 2-3 weeks ago, something like that, we had our previous satsang. What is really bhakti? No? And what does it mean to surrender oneself to God? So today I was filming this afternoon for the Yoga Sutra. And when the whole thing was over, it's just the context, I even don't remember the context. You know, Professor Kiri was here and Shaili and Mike filming. So I remembered something very special. Long time ago, it may have been 10 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. And definitely it was after 2001. I was in Japan, first time I was in Japan. Same very place where Swamiji first went and spent time almost 40, 45, 50 years ago. So it was centenary, the 100th birthday of the founder of Mahikari organization, Mr. Okada-san, who had been Swamiji's great friend. When Swamiji very, very first time visited Japan in 1968. There I met a gentleman from Italy. I did not know him at all. And that function was a very big function. And people from all over the world were attending the 100th birthday of the founder of that organization. And I was chief guest there, representing Swamiji. There I met a gentleman. There was Father Maximilian from Assisi. He was there with his whole entourage, including, how do you say, his band people, Mira? Italian band people with their, actual music, etc. They had their art, and you know, with their costumes, Italian costumes, boots all the way here, red dresses, you know, and their hat, cap. And so it's like, I think the organization had hired them from Italy to be part of the ceremony. So when I went, for example, when I walked on the stage, so I was greeted in a full, it's like Pope is, even the Pope doesn't get, the Europe has, you know, really undergone a tremendous change. So the poor Pope doesn't get all that, you know, special honor anymore. So, but the Italians still know how to welcome the Pope. So that kind of welcome was there. And Father Maximilian was the Father Maximilian, Missy Maximilian, something like that. Well, a few years later, I was in Assisi. There was a yoga conference organized by European Union of Yoga. And so I arrived there two days earlier. And so I remembered Father Maximilian. I asked somebody, I asked people that whether they know someone is Father Maximilian. Oh, yes. And of course, he was a very, very, very respected man. So I visited his place, and he was very gracious. And I spent lots of time with me, taking me around, showing me things, and really explaining. And in Japan, when I had met with him, I didn't know much who he was, what was the depth of his. Of course, from his personality, from his demeanor, it was definitely clear that he was a very special soul. So in the course of conversation, I told him that I'm there to give a presentation for a group of yogis who have organized this conference. So he asked me the time of my presentation. I told him, he said, hey, let's see if I may have time to stop by. And he really did it. By that time, I was on the stage giving lecture. And I think my lecture was being translated from Italian to English, or I was giving just in English and people are listening in English. And I think it was just pure directly in English. I was 5-10 minutes into my presentation when I saw Father walking into the hall. It was very quite big conference, maybe 400-500 people. And it was being held in Assisi. I saw Father standing at the door. So I stopped. I welcomed Father. And I told the audience, I don't know how many of you know, Father Maximilian is here. And people looked behind. Every single person in the audience got up. And with humility, you know. And everybody, it's like Father is there, so everybody went like this. So I requested Father to come, but by the time Father came in the front, I realized that no, he deserves a much more significant place than just sitting in the audience. So I requested him, and he was hesitating. So I asked the audience, isn't that Father should come here? Everybody said, yes, yes, and immediately people rushed and brought a chair. And Father sat there. And at the end, I asked if Father can speak a few sentences. That was so enlightening. This humble Father got up. And I will tell you just few things which may be kind of self-admiration sounding. But it's amazing what he said. And the last sentence, please pay attention to. He spoke maybe 3 minutes, 5 minutes. And spoke in Italian. And somebody came and translated for me and for those who did not know Italian. So few things he said. He said, I met Panditji first in Japan. And I met him in a very, very large gathering. There are 30,000 people. And Panditji was stormed by the organization, he was protected by the organization. But I had an opportunity to sit for a few minutes next to him before he went on the stage. There I felt that I was in the company of a blessed Son of God. I'm listening here, I'm feeling so embarrassed. I am blessed Son of God. Well, then he said, then I had honor of being with Panditji and his lovely wife for breakfast in the hotel. At that time, Panditji's time was dominated by the Duke of Luxembourg So it was just the company I was in. But it was extremely delightful. When you are in the company of a person who has walked closer to the Lord, you feel it. Provided you have made some effort to walk closer to God. And thus, in the process, you have experienced how it feels moving toward God. Before that, it is just a theory. Then he dropped that conversation there. Today I am here attending lecture presentation on yoga. And I feel it is all right to share a part of my life which normally I don't share. And that is, I was introduced to yoga long time ago, perhaps 50, 60, 70 years ago. Since then I've been practicing asana, little bit breathing, and little bit technique of meditation. And the summary of what I learned from the sages of the East is this. In order to succeed in any endeavor, you need a healthy body, clean, calm, tranquil, and one-pointed mind. Asana gives you a healthy body. Meditation gives you a clear, calm, and tranquil mind. With your healthy body and clear, calm, and one-pointed mind, you discover a vast wealth that God has deposited right in your body and mind and senses, and the vast gift that God has given to this wonderful world by coming in touch with your body and mind. You can discover what is within you. You can discover what is outside you. By the time you have gained access to your body and mind, you have become somewhat a little bit wiser person. Even though you are not super enlightened soul, you have not yet met God, and you have not yet known yourself. And yet, just because you have become more sensitive to what is going on in your body, what is going on in your body and mind, that has given you additional wisdom. With that wisdom, you can discover so far what you have not discovered in your body, and you can discover so far what you have not been able to know about the world outside you. The more you know yourself and the more you know the world outside you, the wiser you become, because then you start seeing that everywhere, in every aspect of your life, in life inside you and life outside you, a just manifestation of our Lord. And at that moment of realization, even you don't need to make an effort, to just offer everything that is in your body, that is in your senses, that is in your mind, and any achievement that you have, you just automatically, you offer it to the Lord. This offering to the Lord is called, you know, ultimate fruit of yoga sadhana, yoga practice. This trustful surrender is the ripened state of the fruit of your all practices that you have ever done in your life. And in order to ripen, a tree and the fruit hanging on its branch does not need to make an effort. It just happens. Do everything at the level of your body and at the level of your mind. Do as much as you can. And as far as the result is concerned, you just sit and watch and wait. Never, you do not need to pray to God, asking Him to help you mature your good deeds. You do not need to request God. God, please help me here, help me there, guide me here. That is a sign of ignorance. But rather, to understand exactly how much you have gotten and how little you have worked for it. Just offer it. Offer your body, offer your senses, offer your good, offer your bad to the Lord the Almighty. That is the final fruit of every good thing that you have done in life. This is what allows you to sit next to the throne of Lord and experience being somewhat similar to what our Father in the heaven is. I said, my God, and even I'm adding some commentary here. Father said all these things in 5 minutes' time. See here, we talk about these big, big books, as some of you, Dr. Ganesh is here, you know, Dick Rubeja is here, Pat is here, many of you, Rajani Bhai is here, Petra, Sandy. We have seen Swamiji, that hardly just, you know, an entire 1 hour, 2 hour long lecture or teachings, he spoke about a book or he used any references. It was extremely simple. Even when he taught the Yoga Sutra or Bhagavad Gita, hardly he spoke about one sutra when he's defining yoga. Chitta vritti nirodha yoga. Even he didn't bother to be from a scholarly standpoint, he did not even bother to be perfect, correct. The actual sentence sutra is chitta vritti yogas chitta vritti nirodha. You have to say yogas chitta vritti nirodha when you study with the traditional pundits. You can see that they are just, if they find you, they will put under your teeth and grind you. Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. No. Chitta vritti nirodha yoga. Simple. If you are bothered by the inaccuracy of Swamiji's pronunciation, work out your problem. You know, he's not bound. He is bound by the comprehension of and the responses of the audience. He is talking to his students. Goal is to communicate. Goal is not to show off that how much he knows. Okay? So you read, there is a 4 or 5 or let's say a set of 6 videos, I think, or maybe even 8 videos on the Yoga Sutra. How simple, how practical his teachings are on the Yoga Sutra. Saundarya Lahari. We make things complex. You know? What does it mean? This is something very important to remember. This is how I was also guided by some of my initial teachers. That is, see how straightforward, simple, and right to the point is the teachings. It means that person is speaking from experience. That person is closer to the truth he or she is trying to communicate. Similarly, you can look at yourself. That when you are trying to practice, let's say surrender, bhakti, love, devotion. First thing, this is a subtle matter. It's not that you say, well, here is how I love God. No. As long as you have some rigid kind of preference to express your love to God by doing this ritual or that ritual, it means you are quite far away from God. God is not something or someone who was born long after those ritual ingredients were listed, by somebody. God existed long before that. This tendency of loving God without knowing anything about God is a very, very, very ancient disease human beings are suffering from. The less we know God and more we proclaim to love God, the less we know God and more we proclaim to love God is a disease which humanity has not been able to cure. As a sincere seeker, you have to watch it out. No? You have to be very vigilant. Because what happens here, you are drawn, you are means all of us, we are drawn not to God, we are drawn to our own samskaras, our own vasanas. One of the strongest vasana is asmita, self-identity. Self-identity, which is always afraid of knowing the truth about itself. We are afraid of discovering an unfamiliar part of ourselves, fearing that it might be something I do not like to have. And if it turns out that is a part of myself is very real, very true, it is very devastating. So we refrain from knowing ourselves. And we make ourselves comfortable to hang on to that part of our self-identity which is convenient to us. So we worship the phenomena of convenience. Okay? So on one hand, here is, let's say, a positive way of connecting myself to a particular God. Shiva, Vishnu, and Judeo-Christian tradition was very intelligent tradition, very smart, intelligent, that they did not give too many names to their God. They simply said God. And the maximum they have said, God our Father in the heaven. Therefore, they are in much more healthier position than those who really, really came up with 1,000 names of God and plus more. First, they thought that by doing so, they are getting an expanded vision of God, because each of those names represent a particular aspect of dimension of that vast nature of the reality. What they did not realize that people have hard time. It's like, you know, how can you see the Himalayas simultaneously from every possible angle? Even if you choose a million different points where you can stand and see Himalayas, still you will not be able to see the whole Himalayas at once. And even if you saw it from 10,000 different vantage point, you have no capacity to put together all those different views in your mind. And after seeing 9,000 and 10,000 times and 11,000 times and 99,000 times and 100,000 times and million times. Throughout your life, in let's say for 80, 90 years, you just stand here, look at. Then you stand over there, look at the Himalayas. Stand over there, look at the Himalayas. And you gave name, Haridwar, Rishikesh, Har Ki Pauri, you know, Annapurna, Mount Everest, you know, Kathmandu and Kanchenjunga. From all those different, then one day you go on the other side of the Himalayas, you know, from Hindu Kush, you know, era, from Pakistan side, from China side, from Tibet side. Even if you do so, our mind, our brain has such a limited capacity to string together all those different views that you have seen from different vantage points. Even though you gave name to all those vantage points, and the Himalayas seen from those different points, even you might give a name to those different aspects of the Himalayas. You may say this is Badrinath, this is Kedarnath, this is Tunganath, this is Valley of Flowers, and this is the Divine Mother's place, and this is Shiva's place, this is Vishnu's place, and this is all these different things. This is Shivling Parbat, and this is the, all those names you give to the same very mountain. So what happens is, first thing, we never get a complete view. Second, even if we got it, suddenly we develop our own special affinity. We add our own preferences by the time I lived in the United States for 36 years You know which part of Himalayas is very, very nice to me? That may not have been the case 36 years ago, 38, 40 years ago. But now the best place in the Himalayas is, which is quiet. And there are some basic amenities. And I have a nice toilet to go to the bathroom. And in the morning, I have hot water. That particular place in the Himalayas is the best. All these so-called wonderful shrines are no longer meaningful to me. 40 years ago, they are very, very meaningful to me. Now I do not need to be at Badrinath or Kedarnath, even in the vicinity of that. If there is no place for me to sit down and do my practice, do my meditation, have right kind of food and right kind of water, and be able to go for a walk in the morning. Look here, how things have changed. People rush directly to that shrine. And even when they go to Badrinath, Kedarnath, those wonderful shrines, they just boom, like straight, they get out of their bus, pilgrims. And they just go and same, you know, they go to the temple, pushing, 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 pulling, elbowing, shouting, crying. Half of the mind is on the temple, on the shrine. Another half of the mind is on their wallet, purse. You can, if you split mind in two, so there are only two halves. Half the mind on the wallet, half the mind on God. But now they have to slice a little bit portion of the mind from this half and that half so that they can have an eye on their shoes. Okay? Now, see here what we love. We love a God who is just like us. Whose qualities, characteristics are somewhat compatible to the qualities and characteristics of our samskaras, the building blocks of our own mind, our own personality. In Yoga Sutra, it's called Karmashaya. We invest the amount of energy we can invest in God, only the amount of energy which is left over from the rest of our all other investments. And you can see how much of our mental energy has been invested in our shoes when you visit a temple, a church, or mosque, and you come out of the temple, church, and mosque, and your shoes are missing. How upset you are when you lost your shoes. That tells you where your investments are. For a yogi, for a seeker, it is very important to watch that what is there which is preventing me to move closer to our Ishta Deva, our Lord Almighty, Divine Being, our Creator, our Progenitor. What is there that is preventing me? Removing those elements which are serving as obstacles is as important as actively moving toward God. But however, problem is because we don't know much about the inner reality and our relationship with that inner reality, we get caught in the names and forms. And to justify, we call it our dharma. And to demonstrate that how dedicated we are to our dharma, our faith, we want to be radical. When you look at this world, it's very bizarre. From the standpoint of Hindus, there are at least 6 billion infidels. Even in more than 6 billion infidels. From a well-established, from the standpoint of his well-established, a gentleman, a person, grounded in Islam, how many infidels are there? Who need to be eliminated, because the more infidels you eliminate, the closer you will be to God. So 6 billion people have to be killed in order to really serve God truly. Then how many more within Islam? There are around 200 million Shiites. They are infidels. There are few million Ahmadis. There are few million Aga Khanis and Ismailis. There are different sects within Islam. There is such a great pride among a certain group of extremists, when they kill a bus full of Shia Muslims in the streets of Karachi, Pakistan. These are the Sunni people who did it. Just imagine where our preferences are going to be. How much does it add to our love and devotion and trustful surrender or all the purity that we wish to gain by doing our prayer or meditation or reciting Quran, reciting Bible, reciting Bhagavad Gita or Vedas and the Upanishads? How much purity do we gain by involving ourselves in what you call these unnecessary acts of dharma, religion? But and it's common sense. By burning somebody's harvest, just by burning somebody's harvest, we do not fill our store with grains. We do not become rich. We do not become richer by hurting and harming and destroying somebody else's wealth. To understand this, we do not need to be educated somewhere in a university. We don't need an advisor and counselor, a guide to tell me that you become rich by earning money, not by destroying somebody else's money. You become beloved of God by loving God, not by hating those who do not believe in your God. It's extremely common sense. And yet, we do not care for this open truth. We do not have respect for this. We have respect for only what is compatible to our samskaras. There is an element of anger, hatred, jealousy, attachment, desire, fear, violence, cruelty, love, lust, possessiveness, greed. So we gravitate toward that. And to justify that act, we put all those actions in the category of a dharma religion. This is what is very, very important when you are following the path of sadhana. This is even more important in the practice of bhakti yoga, path of love, devotion, and trustful surrender. Unless we cultivate a worldview which enables us to see the world inside us and the world outside us to be filled with our own Ishtadeva, the Lord of life, we cannot really practice bhakti. We'll be constantly bumping into the undivine nature of things. And we'll have no time to embrace the divine. So when you read any of the scriptures, any of the texts, so that it's Bhakti Sutra, Yoga Sutra, Bhagavad Gita, how much emphasis has been placed on don'ts is unbelievably vast. You read whole Bible. Tell me exactly where Bible says that this is how you worship me. Entire whole Old Testament. Let's say if it consists of a quarter of a million words. In that quarter of a million words, how many words are talking about here is exactly how you love God. Here is how you communicate with God. Here is how you connect yourself to God. Here is how you walk toward God. Here is how you sit next to God. Here is how you surrender yourself to God. Do you have any idea how many words have been used in the Bible to describe this thing? Shocking. Hardly few sentences. 10 commandments. Can somebody recite those 10 commandments one at a time slowly, please? Devaraj is not here. She is my source of Catholicism and Bible. Let's say Bible. Sandy, come on, help me.
No other gods.
Okay, start from.
No other gods. No images. No taking the Lord's name in vain. No taking his name in vain. Honor thy mother and father. I forget. No, there's one more.
See, no other gods. What is God? Come to me, I will talk to you next lifetime. Okay, start from there. No other God but the God, whatever. Huh. No other God and?
No images.
No taking
the Lord's name in vain.
Yes.
Honor the Sabbath.
All these things, perhaps honor the Sabbath. how still come next lifetime I'll talk to you. So the see here, don't do this. Can you, sir, tell me what should I do? No, it's not there. Why? Because that is where people are spending so much time, coveting others' wealth, adultery, hurting, harming their neighbors, and worshipping images. How? Those who do not worship the image I worship, they are infidels, and therefore eliminate those who do not worship my image of my God. So if you look at, there is a reason why these scriptures are filled with don't do this, and how little they say, what should I then do? And even if they say that, then they don't tell us how. What may be available out there? How is hardly available out there. Because all these great souls, those who jotted down these experiences, they saw, where are we investing our consciousness and our intelligence? And whether that investment is right investment for right purpose in right place or not, they found that it was all faulty. Yogis saw it. There are few extremely straightforward, blunt teachers. Christ is among one of those blunt ones. There are examples of many other such blunt, great souls. And all of them got crucified. Buddha was not as blunt as Jesus Christ. And he was not as blunt as Moses. He was not as blunt as Vishwamitra and Parshurama, and still he got poisoned. So yogis came up with some very standard guidelines. They call it kushalam kushalatvam. You will become kritartha. You will complete the mission of life. You will find life's purpose only when you live wisely and tactfully. This tactfulness is called kushalam. Very, very important thing. When you are following the path of truth and trying to walk closer to your own inner being, God Almighty, be tactful. If you have only few days left in your life, and before that, if you have already attained the entire knowledge that you are supposed to achieve, and when the loss of your life does not really make any much difference to you, and if speaking bluntly about truth is really somewhat helpful, useful for others, then during the last few days of your life, you can be that blunt, be crucified, and depart joyfully with a lovely prayer. Forgive them, Father, for they do not know what they do, what they are doing. With that kind of prayer, you leave this world. But when you know that you have still 20, 30, 40 years to go, Don't be blunt. No? Be tactful. Vyasa, in the commentary of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, he brings up this point several times. Several times. Unless you are as powerful and influential as Krishna, and unless you are supported by a large number of wonderful people, his own invincible brother Balarama, an invincible warrior like Arjuna, and many, many others, and time to time, Krishna is able to retrieve the divine powers which are not humanly possible on this earthly plane. Thus, time to time he was recalling, retrieving his own divine weapons, his own wonder, you know, powerful, valiant vehicle, Garuda, who could increase and decrease the size of his body, who could assume the size of a mountain and yet fly in the sky at the speed of light, and with the air produced from his wings, he could, bring tsunami in the ocean and blow the mountains and shake the planet. Krishna is like that. So he can afford to be blunt. And still, if things did not work, then he could assume his cosmic form. Here is in me the entire universe, all these stars and planets and galaxies, all these primordial sages and the celestial snakes. Here is how I have already finished this whole planet in akrama non-linear fashion. Wake up, Arjun, better you do my job. Well, how many of us are like Krishna? So better let's not be blunt. So what does it mean here? Be extremely practical. Watch yourself and observe where do you gravitate so spontaneously and almost effortlessly. And consider that to be an obstacle in your journey toward the Lord of your life. Conquering that kind of vritti, that kind of tendency, is more important than talking too much about God. Only those who do not know, they alone talk about God. Talking about God is like name dropping. If President Obama and yourself are really good buddies, and even when he is in Oval Office, he visits you and your children, has dinner with you at your home, or has dinner with him, with you at his White House, at the White House. Do you know how little you will talk about President Obama? How careful you will be about your relationship with the President Obama? When you are not grounded in yourself, When you are almost a baseless fellow and trying to build a base and you do not know any better way of building it, then as part of name dropping, you may talk about President Obama and his dog. And you express, you communicate your intimacy with the president by all the time talking that how you love his dog and the tail of his dog. One day you were just walking, sitting in the, you know, in the White House, and this dog came and started, you know, rubbing his tail against you. All this, you know, gossip. It's not called bhakti. It's not called demonstrating your intimacy. A wise person, experienced person will know. And in a matter of minutes, anybody who knows the protocols of the White House and the dignity of that office will know that you are almost as good as a trash. That is what exactly this whole idea of God is. Once upon a time, when Swamiji was living in Almora, a part of the Himalayas, very beautiful place, with his very best friend, Nantin Baba, at that time, Anandamayi Ma, a great lady sage, was on her way to Mount Kailas and Mansarovar in Tibet. In those days, people used to go through. There are few routes which are now closed, you know, after this new juggling, border juggling took place between India and China in 1961 and 62. Since then, those routes have been closed. Otherwise, there was a direct route directly from Badrinath to Mount Kailas, and there was another one from Almora. So Anandamayi Ma camped outside Almora town. That is where in those days Swamiji, no, Swami Rama and Nantin Baba were staying. So they came to know that Anandamayi Ma is passing through. So these both, and they both were young at that time. So they came. There was chanting going on. And they sat in the audience, completely in the back. And in their pose. And everybody is doing chanting. So people, those who were accompanying Anandamayi Ma, felt offended. That why are these young sadhus not participating in chanting? So a couple of times some, you know, people came. They gave some musical instrument, no? This mazira, what's called that mazira? Anybody knows it? That little thing that you... Symbols, yeah, something like that. Then somebody came. Do you like to do play any harmonium or anything? No, thank you. Well, the whole thing is over. Anandamayi Ma came when everybody was leaving. He stood there. Very lovingly. And these sadhus also got up and very lovingly they bowed their head respectfully to each other. And Anandamayi Ma left and they left. Now everybody in her camp, they became like pest. How lucky you are, Ma is stopped by How lucky you are. She directly looked at you, and how I feel pity for you guys, for you people, that you didn't recognize who she is. Thank you, you know, whenever, you know, God wishes we will recognize each other. Now they're trying to leave, but these people, they don't let him leave, let them leave, bothering. However, next day, they came again. As soon as they entered the campground where Anandamayi Ma was staying, whole commotion started. These devotees, instead of doing their job, now they are just like swarming, like hornets. You should behave like this, you should sit like this, it's very arrogant sounding, this like this, you know. And she is the greatest sage of our modern India. Nobody is equal to her. And Nandin Baba said, that's why we are here. So, when they stood there, took part in the assembly, but they're just sitting quiet. So, don't you like chanting? No. We are enjoying it. So, again Anandamayi Ma stopped. So, Nandin Baba said, Ma, it seems like people here are too agitated through our presence. Perhaps it will be better that we don't come here. She felt so bad, she just embraced, started sobbing. And you know what she said? That's thousands like you, thousands like me have come in this world and have not been able to help people rise above their inner agitation. But please, on account of such a bitter truth, pervasive bitter truth, do you want your mother to suffer? How much I will miss you if you are here in surrounding. They became very emotional. No, Ma, I'll come. Next day she held a special meeting. And she said that, do you know who they are? You are shouting, chanting at the top of your lungs. They are hearing the song deep in their heart. And you have no sensitivity to pay attention to this phenomena. That who are you trying to prove that your or your guru or your path is better than anybody else? Proving, as long as you are trying to prove, it means you are in the service of that asmita, self-identity that is comprised of your samskaras, feelings, and subtle karmic counterparts, subtle impressions of your karmic counterparts. So you are actually worshipping your samskaras. Watch out. This phenomena is more applicable, this particular point is more important for those who choose to follow the path of bhakti. And the truth is, there is element of bhakti in all of us. Element of trust and faith is in all of us. Regardless how little you know about the sages, about the depth of their teachings, somewhere deep in your heart, there is a very amazing understanding that there is higher wisdom, and there have been some souls in the past, those who have seen that higher truth, those who have experienced it. And there are places, there are people even in our modern times, those who have at least to some extent embodied that wisdom and knowledge. And there is a great joy in being in the company of such people, or being in the service of such people, or their work and mission. This is what has brought all of us here. If you really look and observe your own life, what brought you to Himalayan Institute, for example? Initial, instigating factor may have been something which you can pinpoint, but the truth is, the deeper aspect of the cause that brought you here is very subtle. And that subtle cause, if you, with your calm, tranquil, one-pointed mind, when you start analyzing, you will see that your own very unique understanding of the reality and the possibility of that reality's revelation, and your own desire to come in touch with that reality, that was had brought you here. Whether you are, let's say, involved in any of the office work, you are involved in, you know, our service in the kitchen, whether you are part of seva program, somewhere something is there in your mind and heart that tells you that it is possible to come in touch with that higher reality. And a place that is conducive to coming in touch with that higher reality is a special place. Let us see where it is. So you are already on the path of bhakti, on the path of trust, on the path of faith. You do not know exactly what it is, where it is, and whether or not it is 100% sure that you will find what you are looking for, and yet you are here, you are looking for it. That's why you go to certain places, that's why you interact with certain people, that's why you study certain texts and scriptures. So this element of bhakti, love, trust, faith, self, you know, trustful surrender, it's there. Some of us are more aware of it, and some of us are not so aware of it. Thus, we are on that path. Important thing is to pay attention to your own, you know, long cherished samskaras, your karmic possessions, and see whether those samskaras are somewhat flexible and helping you move into the direction of that truth, or they themselves are becoming obstacles. How often your mind runs away from the goal you have decided to reach, that tells you that there is something still pulling you backward. Identify what it is. Work it out. That is what you call the practical, functional dimension of bhakti yoga. God bless you. If you have any question, we can discuss that. Okay. I can't see the clock from here. Huh? 9:20. Okay. Then let me see two of you. Because you are leaving tomorrow, probably, no? Okay. So, good. Thank you. God bless you.